Right, today I'm talking to Rupert Mackerson. Should be Sir, but he said Rupert is fine. He's known to many race goers as the genial gentleman that runs a Mowbray bookshop on race courses, selling prints, books, etc. What many people may not know, he's also a titled aristocrat, Rupert.
No, I'm a baronet. I'm not, certainly not an aristocrat.
But you're a titled, you're a sir.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your early life? Were you brought up in horse racing?
Well, I come from a racing family. We're very much Kent. Myself and my sister are probably the first people not to live near Dover for many generations. My grandmother was one of the Ripleys, and her brother was one of the great amateurs in the late sort of 1890s, early 1900s. Rode winners for the king and people like that as an amateur. And that was on my father's side. And as it happens, on my mother's side, one of our cousins, her second horse, won the Derby in the 30s. So I come from a racing background, hunting, farming background in Kent. So I was brought up with ponies, and then I went on to horses.
I understand you went to Harrow. There's quite a few famous sort of racing people went there. Have you got
My contemporaries, one was John McCrick, who's still with us, and the other who isn't with us, of course, was Julian Wilson. So I was contemporary of two TV people at Harrow.
Were they good pals at the time?
Who?
Were they good pals at the time?
Well, we all knew each other. We all mucked along. We were all interested in racing. I was riding in point-to-points when I was at Harrow.
So then I understand you were, well, you just mentioned you were riding in point-to-points. You're an amateur jockey. How successful were you?
I was probably all right for the first few years. I rode point-to-point winners in both England and Ireland, so I rode quite well for a few years. I had one or two falls too many. I rode some nice winners on the flat in Europe, in Germany and Belgium, so I had six or seven good fun years.
And then I understand you joined the Royal Horse Guards. Were you called up, or did you decide
to... No, I... always was going to be in the army. I went to university in Ireland, where I spent most of my time riding out or riding for a chap called George Wells. And I spent the first 4 years in my family regiment, the East Kent Regiment of Buffs. And when I left university, I transferred into the Horse Guards because I like riding. So I rode around London on black horses.
I understand one of your other sporting interests is coursing. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky. Once again, I come from that type of background, a farming background. I was coursing down in Kent, and I got very lucky as a young man after my father died. I listened to what I was told, and I understood fast Irish bloodlines when no one else did. I won a Waterloo Cup with a half Irish dog. I was given a wonderful dog by a priest of mine, a friend of mine in the army. I won a big coursing event in 66 or 7 at Newbridge with a horse called, well, a dog called Stormy Sirius. And then I went on with a friend of Ernie Gaskin, who was one of the great trainers in the latter part of the last century, and I bought two puppies from him, and I won the Clonmel Derby with dogs called Newdown King and Heathermore King. So I was very, very lucky. I just got lucky. I understood bloodlines and cashed in. I listened to what I was told.
So you must have been quite devastated when the sport was banned.
I think it's a great pity. You know, same with hunting. You know, it's taking away part and fabric of British country life. But it still goes on coursing, I'm pleased to say, in Portugal, in Ireland, in Spain. It's only in England where it's banned.
Now, moving on, after you left the army, where you started to become a little bit notorious, you ran a financial institution in this city, I understand, with some less than savoury characters involved in it.
Yes, I was... when I left the city, I became a successful stockbroker, and I was headhunted to go and run a financial operation called Jupitec, belonging to the Zilker brothers, and that all turned very nasty. People ended up drinking cyanide in prison in Italy, hanging under Black Power's bridge with bricks in our pocket and things like that. There's no doubt if I hadn't left England, I would have been snuffed.
So then you moved to Africa.
Yes, I had. I wasn't quite as silly as people think I am. I knew very well that UDI Rhodesia, which was independent Rhodesia under Smith, was no extradition. So I went to live in Rhodesia, which was great fun, and made a lot of money as a smuggler. It was the last days of a Smith regime, and all the fat cats were trying to get their money out before black rule.
But it all went a bit wrong, didn't it? You ended up in a prison camp, if I
recall. Well, no, it wasn't quite as simple as that. Towards the end of UDI, Rhodesia, where I was living, wasn't recognised by the British government, and the Rhodesians had lost the Bush War, and they're very keen to be recognised by England. So they thought of a scheme. It was a warrant out for my arrest in England. There's no secret about that. So they said, we have Mackeson. If we send Mackeson back to you, would you like us to send Mackeson back? And they said, oh yes, said Scotland Yard, which was at the time treason. They shouldn't have been talking to the officials in UDI Rhodesia. So being particularly stupid, they sent my passport back to England, which the British government promptly cancelled. So they made me a stateless person, which was particularly clever of Margaret Thatcher and all her cronies. And I was shoved into a prison pending being sent back to England. But the Rhodesians and the British government et al. Had a problem. There were no direct flights from England, from Rhodesia to England. It was still UDI Rhodesia being run by Smith. And so they couldn't get me back to England with no way of getting me back. So they deported me with no passport or travel document to South Africa, right? When I'm in South Africa, there's no executive order against me in South Africa, so I'm a free person. And then some horrendous female from the High Commissioner in Pretoria had me carried on to a British Airways plane. Now, she had no right to have me carried on to a British Airways plane. And the moment I got onto a British Airways plane, I fought my way off. Now, I knew perfectly well that you cannot take off any civil airline in anywhere in the world unless everybody's in their seats and belted up, you know, safety belts. So they had a problem, so I was carried off the plane and eventually returned to Rhodesia. So that was game, set and match to me. So I then returned to Rhodesia, and the Rhodesians are now looking particularly stupid. It was at this stage, it must have been extremely funny, that Scotland Yard, of course, as we all know in those days, the Metropolitan Police were all on the take from the press. So Scotland Yard said, on the 15th of May on flight 11XY from Jan Smuts Airport at Johannesburg, Sir Rupert Mackeson will be on it and we'll arrest him. So they turned up at Heathrow with all the press who they're drawing money from. And unfortunately for them, I didn't get off the plane. So they were left with a tremendous lot of egg in their face. And that's when they made the famous remark. But I was number 7 on their 10 wanted men list, and I'd caused more trouble than anybody, Ronnie Biggs. I was then from South Africa, taken back. I had a lot of money with me, I must say. I made an awful lot of money in Africa. I had a vast amount of Rhodesian money with me when I was eventually exported to South Africa, not to England. I was then taken back to Rhodesia by the South African authorities, and they were now fairly stumped. They had failed in their attempt to get me to England, and the whole thing had become a bit embarrassing for Rhodesian authorities, Metropolitan Police, the Home Office, et al. So in those days in Rhodesia, it was strict segregation. You had prisons for white people, you had prisons for the coloureds, Cape coloureds and Asians, and you had prisons for blacks. So they decided that they would break me by sending me to a black concentration camp. I think it was called Carmi. I could be mistaken, outside Bulawayo. So that's fine. I'm driven to Carmi. Now, I'm the only white prisoner there, and I'm put in a cell, right, in a prison block, and and they take all your clothes off, so you're put in a cell. If you were a white man in those days, you're meant to have a bed and mattress and things like that, but if you were a black man, you slept on the floor. Anyway, so I'm put in a cell, a la black man, no bed, and absolutely naked, right? So they unlock all the cells, and out come all the black prisoners, absolutely naked, who stand by their cell. And then they unlock me, and there's a prison governor there, an assistant prison governor, and a couple of white prison officers with sticks to hit me if I'm naughty, and another white prison officer with a dog to bite me if I'm naughty. I mean, I could have been a sort of animal. So I come out, and I go, power, and give a black power salute. Now, then all the blacks who know who I am, because they can talk to each other in the night by leaning out of their windows, they all scream Mackerson and give black power salutes. Now, this completely flipped the prison authorities. So I was then shoved back in my cell. But I was then taken to a prison block where I was the only prisoner, because they thought I was going to lead a riot. It wouldn't have been very hard to lead a riot. There you are.
So eventually, they got you back to the UK.
Yes. I was very lucky. Rhodesia was a mixture of very corrupt people, one or two very nice, honest people. I was very lucky. I had a good solicitor, two good solicitors, a good solicitor in Salisbury when it all started, then an excellent solicitor in Bulawayo called Peter Prinsloo. And I must have been one of the first people ever in the history of, Rhodesia or South Africa to get out of prison on a habeas corpus, which means produced for body. So I got myself out of detention. Or at least Peter Prinsloo did, got me out of detention in front of some famous judge in an international, very famous case on a habeas corpus. Because they completely boxed everything up about why I was in detention. So that was quite fun. One of the funniest things was they sent a psychiatrist to see me. It was the Rhodesian authorities sent a psychiatrist to see me, who said not only was I in good physical health, but seeing what I'd been through, I'd been remarkably sane, which most people probably would disagree with, but he did kindly say that. And then, you see, we used this against the authorities because I was meant to be held for deportation and they had no right to have me psychoanalyzed. So I think I'm then let out, go back to my business for a few months, and just before UDI, the night before Prince Charles let our friend Mr. Mugabe become Prime Minister, I was sent back to England with a pistol to my head. Now, I was told by a prison officer or policeman, all the same, one of Smith's henchmen, now, you either go on that plane tonight back to England, or you'll get a bullet in the head and we'll feed you to the crocodiles. So I can tell you, if you're a question of getting on a plane or being fed to a crocodile, the plane's a very much better option. And when I came back to England, I was very lucky. I had great solicitors again. I had Louis Blomcooper, one of the great QCs, act for me. Lord Chief Justice and two other High Court judge, that was Lord Lane, ruled I'd been kidnapped. And I was once again let free, so it was game, set and match to Mackeson.
I also understand you were sort of on the fringes of the Aspinall sort of crowd back in the gambling days.
Well, you know, I was a young man about town. I knew a lot of the players. I was quite a successful gambler when I was riding and I had horses. I'd been very much on the fringe. I was never gambling, but I knew the players. It was three sets of dishonest people running gambling in London in the 60s and 70s. At the top end you had Aspinall, who was extremely dishonest. His speciality was cheating women. Then one set down was a chap called Peter Scaramanga, who was at Harrow a bit before me. And then at the bottom was a chap called Arthur White and John Washbrook. So three sets of people, and you met them on the race course, but they all used the same crooked croupiers. It was very bent gambling, especially Shemmy. They made certain house players won.
I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, Rupert, but doing my research, I did see that you had a few opinions about Lord Lucan.
Yes, I mean, I think it is common knowledge amongst a lot of people, perhaps I should say, but he was killed. What happened was, he was involved in a very nasty divorce case, and quite rightly the judges thought his wife was a better custodian than him of his children, mad as she may or may not have been. So he spent an absolute fortune on lawyers trying to get custody of his children. Towards the end, he was very much mixed up with John Aspinall, Jimmy Goldsmith, who believed in alpha males. And they concocted very silly an idea of having his wife murdered. They got the hitman, as it happened, from the Ladbroke Club, which was part of, till it was closed down for being undesirable, part of Ladbroke's, you know, the gambling people. They got the hitman from there, and the plan was simple. It was on, shall we say, a Thursday, the day the nanny went out. The idea was that at all times Lucan would be in public view, and the idea in the evening, the hitman who'd got Lucan's key to where his wife and children were living would go in and do the wife and leave the door open. And Lucan would drive past on the way back to Aspinall's Claremont Club and find his wife murdered. End of story, all wonderful. He'd obviously get custody of her children. Unfortunately, for everybody concerned, as we all know, the nanny got murdered because she didn't go out. So all of the hitmen got in happily, got into a building, instead of murdering Lady Lucan as planned, he murdered Ranani, and it all went bottoms up. Police were called, and he went on a run. Now, if people knew Lucan, very weird chap, by then an alcoholic. So if the police had got hold of him, they'd only have to lock him up for 48 hours and show him a bottle of gin, and he returned Queens. And the people who lent him the money to pay the hitman, which included Aspinall, Goldsmith, Selim Zilker, etc., they had all been in the dock with him for murder. Oh, I should say then, of course, people like Aspinall and Goldsmith were pretty tough. They didn't relish being charged with conspiracy to murder, so they sent the hitman down to kill Lucan. So Lucan, within 48 hours, probably 24 hours, of the murder of Ranani, he was himself murdered. As we all know, dead men tell no tales. That's what they used to say down in Romney Marsh, where I was brought up.
So after all the murky stuff leading into the up to the 80s, you became a best-selling author and book dealer, if I'm not mistaken. Can you tell us a bit about your published works?
I mean, I write non-fiction under the name of Rupert Collins, bad fiction under the name of Rupert Maxson. I was very lucky. I became an expert in my picture dealing days with four artists: Charlie Johnson Payne, the cult figure Snapples, Lionel Edwards, Gilbert Holiday, and Cecil Alden. And I wrote with the great author John Welcombe, one of the best racing authors of all time, three very, very successful books on Snapples. The first one, Snapples Life and Works, was a major bestseller. And I'm now in Who's Who. One is because I'm a baronet, the second, I'm meant to be quite a good writer. So I got a bit lucky. Life is a bit about luck, isn't it? Comes and goes.
Another thing that's just come to light, you were very friendly with Lester Piggott.
Well, I was very lucky. I met him, must have been in 58, when I was trying to be an amateur rider. I was with, riding out for the great champion jockey Brian Marshall, who was then trading at Lambourne. He's the chap who rode back-to-back winners of Grand National on different horses for Vincent O'Brien. And we used to go racing a lot. So it was in the 50s I met Lester with Brian Marshall. And, you know, kept up with him. He's the most kind and amusing man to work with. He always comes on my stand at Epsom for a derby, and we normally meet up and have a book signing at the Arc in Paris. But he's great fun. He's very, very amusing, and couldn't be a more generous person with his time. Become very user-friendly, kisses babies, etc., etc.
Any other particular friends in the racing game while we're on you want to talk about?
Well, I used to know Dick Francis, who of course was a great friend of Lester's and wrote Lester's wonderful biography. Always used to do lots of signings at Liverpool for Grand National with Dick Francis, who was used to write books for my great friend John Welcombe. So racing, shall we say, author's world is fairly sort of incestuous. We all know each other. I get on well with Jamie Reed, who would be written three great books recently, Dope, Blown, and Monsieur X. So, you know, it's a nice world to work. If you like racing and you like books, I got a bit lucky.
So, do you looking back on your the colourful stuff that you got up to in your youth, do you regret any of that and wish you'd done things a bit differently?
I suppose, you know, I took a gamble. I went to work for Zilker's. It cost me a lot of money and it nearly cost me my life. But that would be my nature.
Yeah.
When I was riding, I used to gamble, and luckily I didn't have many gambles go wrong. No, I don't think I was cut out to work for Barclays Bank.
So people watching this, they can still find you selling books on race courses now. Which courses do you trade at?
Well, I do every meeting at Epsom, every Friday and Saturday in all national hunt meetings at Newbury, much as I can when it, at Salisbury, when it's a nice day, Salisbury, bit of Taunton, bit of Exeter, bit of Wincanton, I go up north a bit, Warwick. I'm very fond of Aintree, where of course my great uncles or the brothers rode so many winners.
Brilliant. Well, hopefully people come along and buy a few books off you, Rupert, and we do appreciate you talking so candidly to us. Thank you very much.
Okay.
But I just packed up and you've actually told me you're writing an autobiography. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm halfway through my autobiography, which I hope will be amusing. A working title is Mainly Fun and Frolic. I published that amusing old rogue, Michael Pope's books. That's all about fun, and I hope they'll be slightly like my Michael Pope's books.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Rupert.
Starsports.bet provide the complete betting experience. Find us online via our website and app, on course, and at our flagship betting shop in London's Mayfair. 18 years and older only. BeGamblerAware.org.